With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitale, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإن صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Shock and despair in Canada's Indigenous communities with the discovery of more unmarked graves at two former residential schools for Native children. Staying with Canada, the fallout from the trucker-led freedom convoy deepens as Ottawa police chief resigns amid criticism over his handling of the protests. South Korea struggling to keep Omicron in check with the single-day infections hitting a record high. Welcome. Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of dozens of more unmarked graves for Native children. An Indigenous community in Saskatchewan province has found 54 graves at two former residential schools. Saskatchewan Premier has offered sympathy with the Kisikus First Nation, saying they experienced the same shock and despair as other First Nations across Canada. The new discovery brings to more than 1,300 the number of nameless graves found in Canada since last year. The country's authorities forcibly separated the Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where many were subjected to physical and psychological abuse. The Church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg believes Canadian natives suffered many injustices in the process of colonization, including the way their children were treated. Take a listen.
Well, it's not only the children that were devastated. Their parents had their land stolen from them. So it was a theft and a genocide taking place all at once. And if you look back at the history, you see that there really was no intent to deal honestly with. There really was. There was some intent after the American Revolution. The natives were against the revolution because they knew that they would be wiped out and they trusted Britain more. So a lot of them came to Canada, were given land, And then the land was taken away again. So, I mean, at the very top, Queen Victoria was had nice relations with chiefs. But when you go down to the level of surveyors and the agents that were sent out at the local level, they were pressured to give the settlers the land, all of the land. It was supposed to be kept, but 90% of it was taken away. So it's not just the children that were, they were taken to be re-educated in order to become white, pseudo-white, and to forget about the fact that they were the inheritors.
Ottawa's police chief resigns amid criticism that he did not do enough to stop prolonged anti-vax protests that have paralyzed the Canadian capital. Resignation comes as hundreds of trucks remain parked, that is, outside the Canadian Parliament and Prime Minister's office. He says his personnel lack resources to peacefully disperse the protesters, with his defenders voicing fear that the use of force could stoke violence. On Monday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to end protests that have severely affected the country's economy. The demonstrations were started by Canadian truckers opposing an order demanding unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests have turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. Coronavirus infections hitting a fresh high in South Korea, owing in large part to the fast spread of the Omicron variant. Health officials report over 90,000 new infections in the past 24 hours, a nearly double increase from the previous day. Deaths continue to remain relatively low, with an average of fewer than 50 fatalities a day over the past week. South Korea has been among the most successful countries in containing the outbreak. More than 85% of its population has been fully vaccinated, and nearly 60% has received a booster shot. Authorities have been considering to ease some restrictions, including night curfews and bans on public gatherings. But with the current surge in infections, that could be put on the back burner for a while. Our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says South Korean government is caught between a rock and a hard place as it needs to deal with increasing infections alongside growing pressure to ease restrictions.
The government's really in a difficult position here. It had social distancing measures restricting the number of people to 6 and a curfew of 9 p.m. for cafes and restaurants across the country. And it had been planning, as you mentioned, to ease those social distancing restrictions because service industry businesses are really suffering. I was at a demonstration yesterday of hundreds of small business owners that want to see those restrictions dropped. At the same time, however, we see Omicron spreading across the country, with health authorities here warning it could go over 170,000 per day or even 350,000 per day. So the government is caught between kind of a rock and a hard place here. Add to that, we have a presidential election coming up on March 9th, with campaigning just beginning this week.
Russia announces a partial drawdown of its troops near the border with Ukraine in an apparent move to de-escalate the simmering tensions there. The U.S. president, however, is not satisfied with the announcement.
That would be good. But we have not yet verified that. We have not yet verified the Russian military units are returning to their home bases. Indeed, our analysts indicate that they remain very much in a threatening position. And the fact remains, right now, Russia has more than 150,000 troops encircling Ukraine and Belarus and along Ukraine's border. An invasion remains distinctly possible.
Biden says the West will respond to a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine with military and economic measures, including shutting down the Nord Stream 2 project for good. That's the vital pipeline that would transfer Russian gas to Germany once it becomes operational. The U.S. president says NATO doesn't have missiles in Ukraine nor any plans to deploy them there. Meanwhile, the White House says Washington could impose sanctions on Moscow even if there is no invasion. The statement comes as a majority of Senate Republicans introduce a measure that would slap sanctions on Russia. Talks are also underway in the Senate for a separate bipartisan anti-Russia bill. The Yemeni army releases footage showcasing its advanced drone technology and capabilities. The video includes footage of drones used in the Yemeni army's latest attacks against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates. The Saudi-led coalition has in recent weeks intensified its attacks on Yemen, targeting civilian infrastructure, including telecom stations, across the war-ravaged nation. The Yemeni army, in turn, has ramped up cross-border retaliatory strikes. Sana'a says it'll continue the operations until the aggressors end the war and lift the blockade on Yemen. Activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says the footage proves the allegations that the Yemeni army launches its drones from civilian areas is totally false.
This release of footage is a clear proof that shows that the Saudi and United Arab Emirates claim that those drones are launched from a populated area or that they are launched from airport. So this footage shows that launching those drones is just simple. They just need three metal bars and you can put them anywhere in rural area in Yemen and then you can launch them very quick and very fast. There is no need for runway. And as well, we have seen that those footage were so clear that the Yemeni army has not hide the mountains or the landscape. Because if you see, there is some programs, either Google Earth or Google Map, that when you see a landscape, you can, from that picture of the landscape, find the area that those drones were launched. And I think this is as well a clear proof that anyone can look out and find that those drones were actually launched from area across Yemen. And as well, it is proof when United Arab Emirates and Saudi always claim that they have targeted the so-called the launching site. I mean, it's just three bars. They have used as well rocks just to hold those bars and then put the drones on the top of it. So it exactly shows that it's so simple to launch these drones from any area in Yemen.
Russia reaffirms its cooperation with Syria in its battle against the remnants of foreign-backed terrorists in the Arab country. During a visit to Damascus, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said Moscow will continue fighting until Syria regains sovereignty on all its territory. Shoigu made the remarks during a meeting with President Bashar Assad of Syria. The two sides also discussed Russian humanitarian assistance to the Syrian population, which is suffering from sanctions imposed by the U.S. and Western countries. Shoigu also briefed Assad on the naval drills being conducted by the Russian Navy. Moscow has deployed military equipment to its airbase in Syria for massive naval drills in the region. Gunfire and explosions in Somalia's capital, where security checkpoints and police stations come under a fresh attack. At this time as well, the culprits are Al-Shabaab militants. The number of casualties is still unclear as police are investigating the incident. Last Thursday, the militants, who have links to Al-Qaeda, targeted a convoy of parliamentary election delegates in Mogadishu, killing at least six people. Almost a decade ago, the Al-Shabaab militants were driven out of Mogadishu after an offensive by an African Union force, but they still control some rural areas and frequently launch bombings and gun assaults in Mogadishu and elsewhere. Political divisions and prolonged delays in elections have allowed them to make some gains recently. Now, a number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan horse affair rocked Britain in 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate, which affects ordinary British Muslims today. Robert Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to the victims of what's now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over, and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Iran's major performing arts event, titled Fajr International Theatre Festival, has come to an end with an award ceremony. The 40th edition of the annual event has attracted theatre troupes from Iran and around the world who would stage their plays over the course of 12 days. Yusuf Jalali is on that story.
Iran's major performing arts event, Fajr International Theatre Festival, wrapped up with an award ceremony on Tuesday. During the 40th edition of the annual event, theater ensembles from Iran and the world took to the stage to perform plays. And the best performances are now honored here.
It's important that we as young actors are evaluated by the jury. This gives us a stronger motivation to continue to make progress. I thank the organizers of the Fajr Theater Festival.
I was awarded for Best Playwright and Direction in the Radio Theater category. This is my second Fajr Award. My first experience at Fajr was at the age of 24.
Theater is the mother of cinema. Look at the great names in cinema industry. They have all started out as stage actors and actresses. So, Fajr Theater Festival plays an important role in boosting and promoting this important art.
Theater troops from Afghanistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Iraq, Italy, France, Algeria, and several other countries have been performing in the 40th edition of Fajr Festival. Out of a total of 100 plays, 20 are themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, and three others are on the endeavors of health workers during the pandemic. Stage actors believe Fajr Festival provides a platform for the audience to get acquainted with the performing art of different nations.
The festival was a big stage for troops from many parts of the world. It's so interesting for us as actors to see our fellow actors from other nations perform. It also helps us learn about their culture and literature.
Every year in February, Iran organizes Fajr Theater Festival on the anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Last year, the festival was held with no international participation due to COVID restrictions. And this year, the hosting halls have restricted their capacities to 30% amid the emergence of the Omicron variant. The 40th Fajr Theater Festival rolled down its curtain, with some winning a prize and others not. However, stage actors here say, aside from the competitive side of the event, it was a chance to learn about and enjoy the performances of other nations. And that's where the universality of the language of art comes into play. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, that's it for me for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Limelight. In Britain, the former Brexit Minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom. In another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker. The piece is titled, David Frost Joins Tory MPs in Calling for Return of Fracking in UK. In Britain, the former Brexit minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom, in another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. Lord Frost argued that extracting domestic shale gas would give the UK a competitive and reliable source of energy. But Zach Goldsmith, a key green voice within the government, said it would not reduce energy prices and would put ministers at war with furious communities. The letter to the Prime Minister was organised by the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group of Conservative MPs, which argues against many green levies and targets, saying the government should prioritise lower energy costs and more secure supplies. Last week, leading climate scientists told The Guardian that the group appeared to be trying to delay a shift towards lower emissions by including climate policies in a cultural war and spreading disinformation, a charge that the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group rejects. The MP's letter, shared with the Sunday Telegraph, said shale gas deposits around Lancashire and surrounding counties offer at least 50 years of cheap and sustainable gas. It read, "If levelling up is to mean anything, it must be centred around empowering communities, rather than telling them what they can and cannot do. With a lack of public debate about our strategy to reach net zero emissions, we have abandoned this fundamental Conservative principle. It's time to reverse this moratorium." The Sunday Telegraph said 29 MPs had signed the letter, but named only five of them: Craig McKinley, Steve Baker, John Whittingdale, Bob Blackman, and Julian Knight. The organisers of the letter declined to reveal any more names. The former Brexit minister David Frost, who has emerged as a leading dissident voice on the Tory right since resigning from his ministerial role in December, told The Telegraph that fracking would bring a competitive and reliable source of energy and reduce reliance on imports. But Zach Goldsmith, a Foreign Office minister and peer, said that to even replace half the gas the United Kingdom imports would require 6,000 fracking wells, with all the associated industrial equipment and endless movements of trucks ferrying toxic chemicals and wastewater to and from sites. It's hard to imagine communities across the United Kingdom being okay with that. In a series of tweets, Zach Goldsmith said fracking was deeply unpopular with the British public, and that since any shale gas extracted would be sold at international market prices, it would have no impact on UK energy bills. Gas was still needed, he said, but added, "To have any impact at all, government would need to rig the market and go to war with furious communities. On every level, the cost would be enormous." The former Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, who offered fracking companies generous tax breaks in his 2013 budget before drilling licences were later revoked, told the House of Lords committee that extra gas production would only increase employment. George Osborne said fracked gas would be a small proportion of global production and would therefore have little influence on the international prices that dictate what the UK households pay. The government's position remains that fracking is unproven as a resource in the United Kingdom, and that the inability to accurately predict earth tremors associated with it meant it could not be supported. The Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group is campaigning alongside Cordrilla, the company that operated two shale wells in Lancashire. Work at these were stopped in late 2019. When the government halted fracking in England after warnings about possible earthquakes. On Thursday, 10th of February, Cordrilla announced it was plugging and abandoning its two shale wells at the Preston New Road site in Preston, Lancashire, under instructions of the government's oil and gas authority. News of this was announced in a joint press release between Cordrilla and the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group, NZSG, including quotes from the group's chair and vice-chair, Tory MPs Craig McKinley and Steve Baker, calling the decision utter madness. Similarly, the Telegraph article about the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group's letter was published alongside a comment piece from the chief executive of Cordrilla, Francis Egan, calling domestic fracking a no-brainer.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Travelers who never arrived at their destination. The Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
We remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iran entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war. From the second year of the war onwards, they had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamcheh. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight Iran with 6 battalions and 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, 1. The Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. 2. The war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. 3. The flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And 4. there had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country. In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Fah, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6. Over.
Okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We read you loud and clear. Over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them.
350.
The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them. We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order, moved towards Iranian territorial waters, and convinced Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincennes opened fire on Iranian boats.
Zero is inbound.
350 relative?
Relative. Still inbound.
The warning shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all. And the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So, therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their Hilo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with the helicopter and that they were also told to remain on station. Eichmann at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire. And so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22 and violated maritime law.
Officer Deck, presently hold the ship, crossing the Iranian declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
Aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing, it was slow, it was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 mile. It's climbing, it's slow. It doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat? It did not meet any of the threat parameters that were. If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, and if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and this civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
Typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
I did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots, and I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victim.
Air hostile at 004, Truth, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark, and he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here?
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage fall and they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. It was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The Sides was dispatched to go close to Dubai to see if they could find wreckage. And firstly,
the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian F-14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Vincennes. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincennes cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf, we believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident. Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired 2 standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles. An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us." The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contained some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing.
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is.
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about it. He doesn't remember it. I cannot reconcile it.
The reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
The Limelight.
Spyware made by the Zionist regime's notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Zionist Regime Spyware Targeted Palestinian Human Rights Workers. Stay tuned for more. Spyware made by the Zionist regime notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of six Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. Three of the six targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Adamir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, have cooperated closely with the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. The Israeli regime seeks to sabotage that probe and consolidate decades of impunity. The fake regime of Israel accused the targeted groups of serving as arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance group banned by Tel Aviv, Washington, and Brussels. The Zionist regime has not produced evidence supporting its claims. A 74-page secret Israeli regime dossier purportedly proving its case relies on the testimony of two former employees of a seventh Palestinian organization outlawed earlier in the year who are currently in the Israeli regime detention. The Zionist regime likely obtained their testimony under coercion that may amount to torture. Ireland's government, which funds two of the banned groups, dismissed the dossier as containing no credible evidence. International condemnation and skepticism did not, however, prevent the terror designation under the domestic Israeli regime law from being extended by military order to the West Bank, where the organizations are based. The use of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware against Palestinian human rights defenders was revealed by Frontline Defenders, a group based in Ireland. Adam Shapiro, a spokesperson for Frontline Defenders, told the New York Times that the investigation did not definitively prove who used the spyware, but it raises a lot of questions as to the role not only of NSO but also of the Zionist regime. Frontline Defenders stated that the timing of the terror designation's blacklisting Palestinian human rights groups suggests that it is also an effort to legitimate the surveillance of their staff. The Israeli designation of these organizations as terrorists after Pegasus was detected, but just days before this investigation is reported, appears to be a clear effort to cover its actions and disconnected from any evidence that would discredit these organizations, the Irish group said. Frontline Defenders was contacted by Al-Haq in mid-October about the device of Al-Quds-based staff member and a possible infection with spyware, according to the report published recently. After determining that the device had been infected by NSO Group spyware in July 2020, Frontline Defenders began investigating the devices belonging to the staff of other organizations newly designated as terror groups. They found that five additional devices were hacked with the same spyware. Citizen Lab, based at the University of Toronto, and Amnesty International Security Lab confirmed with high confidence that the phones were hacked with Pegasus, Frontline Defenders said. Pegasus is the name of the spyware made by NSO Group. The hacked devices belong to Qassan Halaika, a field researcher with Al-Haq, Obey Al-Aboudi, director of Bissan Center for Research and Development and a U.S. citizen, and Salah Hamouri, a lawyer with Adamir, who the Israeli regime seeks to deport to France for breach of allegiance to Israeli regime. The three other targeted persons remain anonymous. The U.S. Commerce Department blacklisted NSO Group and Candiro, another Israeli regime company, last week. The sanctions barred the companies from buying parts and components from U.S. companies without a special license. NSO Group in particular has come under increased scrutiny with every new report revealing the extent to which its spyware has been used to target journalists and human rights defenders around the world. The Pegasus spyware can be installed remotely on a targeted person's smartphone without requiring them to take any action, such as clicking on a link or answering a call. Most notoriously, the use of Pegasus was linked to the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. Democracy for the Arab World Now recently called on the U.S. to investigate the hacking of the phones of the Palestinian human rights defenders and impose sanctions on those found to be responsible. Four Democratic House lawmakers are also calling for sanctions on NSO Group, arguing that the Commerce Department designation would still allow U.S. investments funds to finance the company. When U.S. investors prop up companies like NSO Group, this implies the asset of the U.S. government, encouraging such companies to continue providing dangerous tools like Pegasus to the most repressive governments, the lawmakers state in a letter to senior administration officials. Meanwhile, a federal judge recently denied a motion by NSO Group to dismiss a lawsuit filed by WhatsApp and its parent company Facebook, now rebranded as Meta, over the targeting of 1,400 of its users with Pegasus spyware over 2 weeks in 2019. NSO Group claimed that it was entitled to foreign sovereign immunity, a protection afforded to government officials even though it is